Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Once is enough. Hello again, friends. Coming to you live from Vachon Island, Washington. This is the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show radiating from the beehive of cultural awareness known formerly as the Gene Bosch Voice of Vachon Broadcast Studio. In the bustling and bodacious heart of our verdant pastoral island community. That was the voice of our founder, Brian Brown. Together, we, the Brieflys, strive to keep Brian's brilliant flame alive by bringing you weekly episodes of intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy and always guided by Brian's mantra of less is more, more or less. Our Briefly panel includes, and let me turn the microphones on so that when I introduce them, they can comment appropriately. Unfortunately, our control board magician, Vachon Artist Commissioner, Airport Commissioner, excuse me, fellow treetop flyer, longest serving Briefly, retired Alaska Airline Captain Truman O'Brien, is home sick today.
So condolences to our true Truman leader at the board.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Get well, Truman. I like that the mics today are wearing masks in his honor.
I did that. We ran out of the little covers that we normally have. And with Truman being ill, I thought, oh, we don't want other people coming in here and making people sick.
It almost looks like, you know, like surgery is going to take place here.
Mm-hmm. I thought it looked sort of like a some sort of doll or something, you know. I should have drawn little eyes on it.
Oh, yes, little smiley faces. Next time.
All right, historian, professor, down under aficionado, and now even more in demand than ever, our guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Holman. How you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing well. It's good to be here today.
Good, good. Part-time politico, ferry service advocate, newly selected executive director of Vachon Household and full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreher.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning, Amy. Mariner, backpacker, rower, and how many more months is this administration going to be around, inquirer, Kevin Jones.
Way too many, I am afraid. But, we're doing our best to, you know, shorten the timeline.
Good, I know. We'll hear a little bit about that, I'm sure, today. Myself, Craig Bellis, I'm a former Gonzaga University constitutional law professor and today's part-time engineer. Today, our small talk guest is renowned storyteller, author, and scholar, Michael Mead. Hi, Michael.
Hello, good to be with you. Morning, everyone.
Good to have you. We are thrilled to have you. Before we focus on the remarkable life's work of Michael Mead, let's start by checking in with everybody and our guest regarding any memorable activities they engaged in over the past week. Kevin, what were you up to?
Can guess.
It was a quiet week. Other than, 1,300 different protests and how many? 3.3 million people, I believe. Turned out and made a showing of their concerns over the state of our current federal administration. And I amongst them and many here on Vachon. I've heard anywhere from 125 to 200 folks were gathered here at the four-way stop on the island. I actually saw photographs. It was awesome. In Olympia, which is our destination, we were kind of doing a crowd check, and you can't see everybody, right, when you're standing in the middle of a crowd of people. We were sort of in the 3,000 to 5,000 range, guesstimating, and now I'm actually hearing numbers around 5,000. So quite a good turnout all up and down the Western Washington corridor. But 1,300-plus individual protests. I have to also say that Opus 5 got off the dock yesterday, and a quick trip over to one of our favorite places, Gig Harbor, Maritime City and a visit to the Tides Tavern for their probably world-famous Reuben sandwich. I kind of have a tendency, if I've been to, not been to a restaurant before, if it's a Mexican restaurant, it's always a Chili Reno. If it's like a sandwich shop, it's always the Reuben.
Oh, that's your litmus test, huh?
Those are the two items, yeah. And so far, Tides Tavern is on the top of the Reuben for sure.
Boy, I tell you, I have lots of memories of the Tides. I was living in Gig Harbor when they opened, and I remember they had their whole wheat pizza, which was, you know, sort of emblematic of the times.
Yes.
So. Interesting story about the Tides Tavern. It was won by the current owners in a poker game.
That's a very appropriate history.
Yes, it is.
And they've done a good job ever since.
They have.
Yeah, they have. Amy, how about you?
Yeah, I panicked when you said that because I thought last week was a blur. I actually looked at my calendar to figure out what I did last week. But highlight was definitely going down to Olympia. So we were down there with the Fix Our Ferries Coalition all morning and into the afternoon, meeting with legislators and talking to them about Fix Our Ferries priorities. And there were there's a sneaky little proviso in there that we all just caught on to about dismantling the ferry advisory committees, which are the community input mechanisms for WSF. And so we are rallying the regional troops on that to see what we can do about getting that put back in. But good news for Vashon, which is we now have funding for midday water taxi in both the House side and the Senate side. So the odds of us keeping our midday water taxi for at least another year have improved significantly, which is fantastic.
That's great news.
It is great news. And, you know, the boats overall, we'll find out because they don't unwrap the bids until May. We do know there will already be a special session May 6th through the 16th in the legislature because the governor and the legislature need to find harmony amongst themselves that they have not yet discovered. So they'll get that done in like 10 days, I'm sure. but that was a highlight because I think one of the things that's been really cool about working on the ferries this year is getting to know all of our other ferry communities. And I think we have a really strong relationship now with the San Juan Islands in particular, which is really cool and valuable. And just that island to island connection has been fantastic.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's great news. Beep, 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 beep. We always get a news break from Amy. At least we hope we get a good news. And we got a good news break.
It's some kind of news.
That's right.
Kevin, yes. And what so was that? I do have a question about that. So first of all, current session runs until April 27th.
Yes.
So cross fingers that all those things are going to stay in place. On the special session, is there any particular focus, all budget related or other stuff?
Yeah, the word on the street is that the governor is not a fan of the revenue measures that the legislature has proposed in order to fund some of our critical programs through the state. And of course, they're facing, you know, $1 billion budget deficit in the transportation. So I think reconciliation of the governor's idea for revenue and the legislature's ideas for revenue will be what they're going to cover.
Mm. Okay. Bruce.
Well, always exciting on Vashon this time of year, watching the daffodils come up and the cherry trees bloom. And it actually gives you that sense of hope that winter may finally be getting over. although the weather right now doesn't seem to belie that, but it's what it is, right? Mm-hmm. Today is my grandson August's 3rd birthday. So,
and
this weekend, we'll have a little party at his place this weekend for him. But just been amazing. You know, you think, you know, at our age, you look back, you know, his world, I mean, he was born 3 years ago. That's all he knows. So like, woo, what a world to be born into. You know, it's just a very interesting kind of thing to reflect on.
Keeping my fingers crossed for all the young people.
Oh, exactly.
Along with us.
Tonight, a little plug, tonight at 6 p.m. at the Vashon Theater, there's a film, I think, I believe the name is Talking Hands, about Native American Sign Language. Should be very interesting sort of film. And then on this afternoon, also going to be at the Friends of Mukai, who received a $45,000 grant from AT&T Community Services to develop a memorial in Oprah Park to the Japanese who were interned, exiled, and imprisoned during World War II. There'll be a ceremony in late May sort of unveiling the design and sort of recognizing what is called Exile Day, May 16th, 1942, is when the Japanese on Vashon were exiled and imprisoned during World War II. So exciting kind of things coming up here.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's backbone, I think, thing at the theater.
Theater tonight, yeah. Right. It's a coalition of island groups that are working with Native American, particularly with the Puyallup tribe.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So it should be an interesting film.
Mr. Mead, how about you this last week?
Well, I'm just back from Boulder in Colorado, where the air is the exact opposite of the air here. It is extremely dry and thin. And I'm glad to be back, strangely, because my eyes couldn't barely take it. And I was surprised at the adjustment required for the elevation, the thinness of the air, and the dryness. So for a change, I'm happy about the rain today.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there doing a presentation at the Art Museum where the theme was The Dazzle of Darkness, and a great exhibition of 30 international artists who work with the idea of finding or reflecting what's hidden in darkness. And my presentation was The Light Inside Dark Times. And then I did a workshop on arts and practice, the idea being that in order to get through these dark times we're in, we need to have arts and practices that keep us centered, grounded, and in touch with our own imagination, because everything around us is going to continue, at least for a while, to be quite disturbing on all levels.
Indeed. You're talking to an expert about going to Colorado. Amy goes there every other day. she buys a 10-top pass
a punch,
in order to
punch
get...
card. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, no, I hear you, though, on that thin, dry air.
Ooh.
January, in January there, I just remembered feeling like a dried-out sponge on the counter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. Me, I went to Saturday's demonstration here at the Four Corners. And Pam Ingalls was standing behind me counting, because Pam Ingalls is a foot taller than everybody else around us. So she was able to, and she actually counted pretty much. And she came up with, turns out at the high point, just about 200.
Excellent.
So very imaginative signs that people had. I'm sure, you know, I saw the social mm-hmm. media on that. There were some dillies out there. Yeah,
one of the best that I saw in Olympia referred to the Burger King. You can just imagine the
yes.
image that went along with that. Yeah.
The other thing that I did was I went to an opening of Bruce Mercer's drawings and art at the BCA. Unbelievable. I'd encourage everyone to drop by there and take a look at Bruce and grab one of the little, magnifying glasses that they have in a bushel basket there or whatever, and look up close at the work that that Bruce has done. And those, one of the things that really caught my attention about that, when you go in, the very first thing when you go into the main side room is on the left, is sort of the beginning. He has a little tiny book of drawings that he made when he was a little kid, and they're cutaways. They're examining the inside of things, which, of course, made up a great deal of his career doing those for National Geographic all those beautiful detail cutaways of the pyramids, or you know, the Enterprise spaceship, or somebody's brain, or whatever the case may be. But it's just a remarkable body of work, and it just has a sampling of it all throughout VCA. And he'll be giving a talk there. I don't have the exact date, but it's coming up here soon. So check out VCA's website if you're interested in that. Okay, let's see. Today is April 8th. Let's also check in as to why April 8th is a special day or a significant day, as all days are, I would hope. International Romani Day, Roma Day. I'm not going to try to be too politically incorrect here, but I have relatives that are Romani. And I remember when I had 16 stitches put in my forearm, I told the doctor, I said, you know, I'm thinking of getting a tattoo over the top of that scar. And he goes, oh, yeah, sure. He goes, wait until it heals, but yeah. So I was running them by my wife and our kids, and I was looking at, I think I may have mentioned this once before, I was looking at Maori tattoos, and my daughter, she goes, you got to kind of get permission to, you know, that's a real cultural appropriation thing, and you know, you really have to find the right Maori, you know, New Zealand tattoo artist. And I said, well, maybe I should go with a gypsy wagon, which would be more appropriate to my background.
and avoid the whole cultural appropriation.
Well, I'd be appropriating my own culture.
Exactly. So. Well, that's
right. That's right.
That's,
yeah, right.
That's allowed.
This is also International Feng Shui Day. Does anybody practice Feng Shui in their home?
Mm. I do.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Do you lay out the flow and everything that way? Or?
Yeah, and I adjust it.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And the direction of your bed, if you have that kind of option? And...
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly. Yeah.
What do you adjust for? And when do you adjust?
Well, it's a part of feng shui. It's that energy is moving through the house all the time. And so you would never have two doorways lined up, because then the energy is just going to move swiftly through and you can't hold good feelings or...
Right, they don't
like
call
that.
It a shotgun house for nothing.
Yeah, and if you go way back, a house would be built so that it was considered to be the center of the four directions. And so that, and each direction would have meaning in it, not just functional meaning, but you're either associating to the rising sun or the setting sun or something of that kind. And colors were introduced into the house based on cosmological significance. And I don't go by it like religiously, but I think about it. And when, I guess what I mean by seasonally is just moving things a little to recognize that we've moved into a new arrangement on the planet, essentially, and with the stars, as a way of keeping alert, which is part of the background of feng shui, because all of that is based on what they call the five element theory in Chinese philosophy.
I don't practice it, but I've read about it and I try to follow it a little bit, and I do find that it does ease my troubled mind.
The home is supposed to be the place where the psyche settles.
Mm-hmm.
And so people used to be quite alert to it and quite careful with it. And the idea of changing with the seasons is a deep, deep thing in Chinese philosophy.
Yeah, cool. All right. This is also National Pygmy Hippo Day. Very important day.
Are they as mean as the big hippos?
Well,
or meaner?
You know, I don't know if pygmy hippos are as mean as full-size or baby full-size hippos.
Did you follow Mudang?
Yes.
With not even Mr. Beat, yes, I did.
Yes, I love hippos.
Follow Mudang.
That's right. And what is a group of hippos called? A bloat.
Amazing.
A bloat. A bloat.
Nice.
That's right. While we're at it, what's a group of giraffes called? A tower.
Wow.
How appropriate.
Man, people are clever.
They are, aren't
they? How did a murder of crows ever come about?
That's right. Yeah. And last but not least, April 8th is International Be Kind to Lawyers Day because they are becoming our first responders.
First kill all the lawyers.
That's right. And that they're working on it.
They're working that
you
whole
want
passage.
Anarchy or oligarchy, kill all the lawyers. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yes, that does remind me. I crossed paths with Chuck Raim at Minglement when the Riverbend was doing their last gig there.
Right.
And he pointed out that there's a, I think, hats, coffee cups, other things. Humankind, be both. Humankind, be both.
Hmm.
I thought that was quite appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think so.
Yeah.
Well, then. I don't think you need to kill all the lawyers. You just need to buy them off. That's what we can see going on right now.
I'm not
going
to let that go without a response.
That's right.
I have been a lawyer for 50 years this year. And there are some horrible people who are lawyers. But the vast majority donate endless amounts of time to the causes that they believe in for free. For pro bono work that they're doing. I unfortunately, there are some big law firms that cut deals with the with the president that I'm not real pleased with, and most lawyers are not pleased with. But my experience, it's the old expression: everybody hates lawyers except they really like their lawyer.
And that's why you donate to the ACLU.
That's right.
Exactly. Well, I'm glad to see those mediation skills coming to the fore right here in real time.
Well, I don't know if that was mediation so much as the professor's lecture skill. Today in history, I'll finish off with this. In 1960, the U.S. Senate passed the Civil Rights Bill with measures against discriminatory voting practices. Something to remember.
Wouldn't happen without a lawyer, I bet.
That's right.
Yeah,
I'm
thinking.
Yep. In 1963, Lawrence of Arabia won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Also one of the longest pictures of that era. And then in 2016, Cheap Trick, Deep Purple, Chicago, even Steve Miller, and NWA were included in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Deep Purple.
Deep Purple,
right?
Who've been around for almost as long as I've been a lawyer.
Yes. Well, I have fond memories.
40 years.
Deep Purple.
Yeah.
Smoke on the Water.
Yeah. A lot of great songs. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's stop with the tomfoolery and talk to our guest today. Our guest, again, is a renowned storyteller, author, scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology, Michael Mead. It's a true pleasure. Having you here with us today, Michael, especially in this time of fear, anxiety, and as you put it in a lecture that I went to, in this time of overwhelm that so many people are experiencing here in the United States and around the world. Can you tell us a little bit about your background? I want to know your origin story before we hear maybe some other stories. What brought you into this unique calling that you have, and how did you end up conclude that part of it by telling us how you ended up on Vashon Island?
So key things happen in youth, or what people call now teenage years, or adolescence and post-adolescence. Something inside a person tries to wake up and become conscious, and that's why they used to have rites of passage, so that a person could make the passage from the end of childhood not into the responsibility of adulthood, but into the awareness of who they already are inside themselves. So I was living on Vashon when I was being interviewed by some newspaper a long time ago, and they said, "How did you become a storyteller?" And I had never thought about it. And then I realized, well, on my 13th birthday, I'm growing up in New York City, blue-collar neighborhood, which means poor people, but really. and my 13th birthday is coming up. My mother asked me what I want, and I say nothing because I had already learned not to ask for what I wanted because I wasn't going to get it and would just depress everyone. But my aunt asked me, "What are you interested in?" And I said, "History." I'm trying to figure out what the hell happened around here, because everybody in the neighborhood is depressed and everybody seems to have lost their dreams. So she goes to a bookstore to buy me a history book, and she's notoriously short. And someone points her to an upper shelf, and she grabs a book. They wrap it up. She brings it and gives it to me on my birthday. I start to tear the paper off, and on the cover there's a flying horse and a guy sitting on the horse shooting this arcing arrow. And I go, wow, I want this book. And she said, oh, it's the wrong book. And I said, no, I want the book. And she said, I'm going to take it back. It's the wrong book. And I tear the rest of the paper off, and it says Mythology by Edith Hamilton. So I read that book that night. I was totally immersed in it. I found a language I had never even heard of. And key for me was I was invited into this world of imagination and connections to ancient cultures and deep human memory, and there was no requirement. I didn't have to be old enough. I didn't have to be educated enough. I didn't have to pay except for the cost of the book. And that's when I was introduced to the language of myth, which I now call the lost language, but also is my language. And so eventually, I found a way to not just be interested in the stories, but tell the stories. And at the time, when I started doing that, there wasn't anyone doing that outside of academia, not at all. And so kind of had to make part of the path on my own.
So how did you actually get into, if you will, professionally telling the stories?
Well, one step makes me think of Vashon, because a long time ago on Vashon, I was always loved music and I loved live music, but I would go to these parties where the musicians would come in with their their axes or whatever you want to call them, and put them down. Everybody get a beer or something, and they wouldn't play. I was there for the music, but they'd get caught up in the social stuff. And so I used to go and say, come on, let's get the music going. And some of them would say, well, why don't you tell a story? And then after that, we'll play music. And so I knew all these stories, but I started that's when I started telling them, with an audience.
You have stories from all over the world. I know you have African stories, you have Indian, Southern Asian stories from different cultures. And you often incorporate a drum. Why do you incorporate a drum?
Well, it's an interesting thing. So when my daughter, and she was born ill, and we took her to 7 or 8 doctors, and no one could figure out. And she wasn't growing. She wasn't keeping food down. And one night I was walking in the youth district in Seattle where I was living at the time, and I had gotten out of the house because someone was going to help with the baby that was having such a hard time. And I was walking in anguish, just anguish, a young father. What are we doing wrong? What's going to happen? And I was passing by a closed storefront when I heard rhythmic music coming out of there, and I recognized it as the music of Zimbabwe. And I went over, and the door was cracked open, and I slipped in, and here was Dumasami Mariere from Zimbabwe teaching a bunch of people in the youth district how to play instruments. And he comes over and starts bumping me with his hip, and he says, what are you going to do? If you can walk, you can dance. If you can talk, you can sing. If you can count, you can play. What are you going to do? And there was a drum standing there, and I said, how can I do that? And so he showed me a rhythm. I stayed the whole night. And, that was the introduction to drumming, which for me was connected to medicine. In other words, I needed that medicine in order to get through this really threatening, dark situation with my daughter. The solution came eventually from a Chinese doctor that saw something that the Western doctors weren't seeing. And but now I was introduced to drumming. And then on Vashon, one day, I was teaching drumming little drumming classes, and I was working on myths and stories all the time. And one day I was trying to figure out what was wrong with this story I found. It was a great story, but there was something wrong with it. Stories get mishandled or broken. And I just happened to pull over the drum that I was learning how to play, and I started drumming, and all of a sudden I could see the story, like a big video thing had just opened up. And it was mesmerizing, and so then I started telling stories while drumming, only later to find out that it's a thing throughout the world in indigenous cultures. In Africa, that's what the griot does, in Shanaki, in Ireland, it's the Shanaki. And when people talk about shamanism, the shamans are drummers. And so it's something that permeates all cultures, and I had stumbled into it.
Hmm. Before I turn this over to Bruce, I think Bruce has a question or two. While we're on the drumming, on a lighter note on the drumming, did I understand you to say at one point years ago when I was talking to you that you might have got involved with a famous rock band or a contemporary band?
A couple, actually.
Can you tell us a little about that?
You mean, are you talking about the Grateful Dead?
Yeah.
Well, when I left the East Coast, I was traveling across the country in a Volkswagen van, and I had the idea at the time I might be a filmmaker. And I had these little 8mm Super 8 cameras, and I was just filming things. And one day I'm in this park in Ann Arbor, and I'm filming water that's being pushed out of a pool by kids playing, and the water's running down the hill, and it's heading, and I follow the water down, and it leads to a stage, a natural auditorium like there in the park, and then a stage, and there's musicians setting up on the stage. So I go from the water to the music, and I'm just filming them setting up, and one of them sits down and starts tuning the guitar, and so I'm filming, he goes, come on up. So I go up on stage, and I'm filming him, he calls, and someone brings a chair, and now I'm sitting next to him. We're having a conversation while he's tuning, and everybody else is setting up in the back. And then I notice there's people coming, and thousands of people pack that park. I have no idea who the musicians are, and I'm just in my little world. And so then they're tuned up and ready to play. And I said, well, I better get off the stage. He goes, no, stay, hang out with us. There's other things being passed around that you could imagine that was creating a kind of a nice smoky attitude, atmosphere. Anyway, so I stayed for a while up on stage filming everybody playing. And then I thought, I better get off the stage. And I go off the stage, and I'm coming down, and I get rushed by people saying, you're with the band. And I said, what band? And they said, the Grateful Dead. So that was,
that's a great chapter.
Mm-hmm. Just sitting in for a bit.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Oh, my. Talk about serendipity. Yeah. Bruce.
Tell us a little bit more about coming to Vashon. And, you know, I mean, you got started on Vashon. You were living down at Spring Beach. Mm-hmm. You were giving Marshall Soul rides, right? You opened a shop called The Minglement, mm-hmm. right? Macrobiotics. And you were a big part of the first Strawberry Festival that involved local musicians and local artists. Just tell us about that time in your life.
Wow. Well, Spring Beach at the time was all summer homes. And I convinced someone over in Gig Harbor, I think it was, to rent us a house down there. And I did that because the first time I came here, driving down that long dirt road down to the beach, something overwhelmed me. I was just stunned, and I thought, I got to live here. Later on, when I went to Ireland, to the west of Ireland, I realized what it was, because it's very similar here to the west of Ireland. And it was really ancestral for me. My background's Irish. And so I found a kind of, you know, I moved from New York City, essentially, to Vashon. And I thought everything was strange, but there was something compelling about it. But at the time, and you know this well, Bruce, mm-hmm. there was very little going on Vashon. So if you wanted a restaurant, you better open it yourself. And I was interested in natural food way back then. And I had to go to Seattle every time I wanted brown rice or some herbs or anything unusual. So when there was a store called The Minglement that was a co-op selling Island Arts and Crafts, but they never opened it. It was never open. And I dropped by there one day, and it happened to be open. And I said, you know, how come you guys are never open? And they said, well, you know, it's a co-op, and we... Anyway, we just don't show up often. But listen, now we're closing entirely. Do you want a store? So I went and sat on the hilltop and thought about, and I went back and said, yeah. So the next day I had a store. Mm-hmm. And so it was arts and crafts, but since I wasn't a natural foods, I turned it into a natural foods arts and crafts store. And so that's how that went. And then, of course, that was now like where Luna Cafe is over there. And the art festival, the Strawberry Festival, was going on, but it was minimally going on. Took maybe 7 minutes for the little things, the horses to go by and things like that. And that was the end. And it was then right there at the main intersection. So one year I just got a permit to open the street from, you know, from the bank to what was the library, which is now the senior center. And so I just opened the street by getting the permit, and I invited all the artists and all the potters and craftspeople to come and set up their own booths, you know, and then I invited all the musician friends who weren't playing at the parties to come and play on the doorsteps of what was the library. And that became, I don't know what you would call it, a second birth maybe for the Strawberry Festival, because instead of ending, it would turn the corner and everybody be walking up and down, and that was the beginning of having booths there and having music performances, and you know, it grew from there, and so on.
What year was that? Do you know?
Bruce might know.
I'm sorry.
What year? Do you remember?
Ooh, that was early 70s.
Early 70s. So,
right. When did you come to the island?
Probably 73.
73.
That might have been 75, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. 74, 75, right in there. Yeah, the festival almost went extinct. You know, it had been run in the 50s and 60s by the JCs, which Junior Chamber of Commerce, and they sort of had aged out, and, you know, the club was sort of disbanding, and nobody picked festival up, and it sort of just limped along. For a couple of years, they didn't even do a festival, and then it picked up, and like Michael said, I mean, it was very minimal kind of stuff, and all of a sudden this, you know, bright wind of sort of counterculture, you know, awareness comes in, and all the folks on Vashon were able to get behind it, because it was a significant change at that time from the culture that had run the previous festival.
Yeah.
You know, where they had, you know, previously they had a Miss Vashon contest, they had sort of beauty contest kind of thing. You know, they had floats all looking like Rose Bowl parade type things, and then all of a sudden it became what the festival still is a bit. It's a very funky Vashon kind of thing, and that traces back to Michael.
That's interesting, because as you know, Truman, who our ill board, you know, runner here, the our engineer and whatnot, we MC the parade, and you, Bruce, have supplied us with this list of everything you've been able to put together in terms of the dates of all the festivals and the names, the Peach Festival and these other, you know, names as it came through. And now I've got a new bit of, not trivia, but history to talk about when we talk about the festival's resurgence. And I will take your name, not in vain, but Michael, that's great to know. Did you have another?
I did too. Let me, you know, you weave together just a tremendous amount of different things, you know, mythology, anthropology, psychology into your messages. And you talk about the mythic imagination. I mean, for many of us of my generation anyway, our first exposure to that was through Joseph Campbell, you know. And what kind of influence did he have on you, and how have you taken that and sort of molded it into what you are today?
Good question. So I first read Joseph Campbell in the late 60s, Hero with a Thousand Faces. That was his most popular book, but also a great book, inspiring to me. I eventually worked with him, which was interesting. And so That was a survey of heroes' journey myths around the world, although it went further than that. The long section on Buddha in there, the life of Buddha and so on. So it really, really went many, many ways. And that alerted me to that first book I had read, Edith Hamilton. It's about Greek myths, but in the back, she included Celtic and Nordic myths. So she had that same inclination that it goes beyond one particular form of myth. They're all interconnected in a certain way. And so he was the only known mythologist in the United States at the time, primarily, even though it has been taught as an academic subject all along. So that was encouraging to me. And but to be honest about it, I disagreed with him about a very basic thing on page 3 of Heroes of a Thousand Faces, which is he called that the monomyth, the one overall myth, like monotheism and so on. And I thought, no, not true. Myth is multiple, not monolithic. And it turned out it was a mistaken idea of his. He was a big student of James Joyce, the Irish poet. And Joyce used a monomyth in Ulysses, but he used it ironically. And somehow Campbell didn't pick that up. And I mention it now because the hero's journey has become the known myth, and particularly in Hollywood, where they use that his description of the outline of the hero's journey as the only journey, and it's just not accurate. And it's important. It becomes important because the hero's journey typically is masculine in style. It's aimed at the outside. It's about achieving and accomplishing in the outside and bringing it back or something like that. And it doesn't speak to everyone. So I started promoting the genius myth. And the idea of the genius myth is it's inside everyone when they're born. The word genius means the spirit that's already there. And so the idea is everybody comes into the world with an inner genius, their own kind of genius. And that means that it's not just masculine, it's feminine, it's trans, it's whatever you want to think it is. It's coming in with the soul of each child born. And so that means each child has something to give to the world, and it's not based on a specific understanding, either psychologically or sociologically or politically. And so so that's the kind of thing I got into. It was a little different from Campbell, although it was inspired partially by him. And when I got to work with him, we discussed that.
And what did he have to say?
He wasn't terribly flexible, as the monomyth might indicate.
So let me, one follow-up question. I mean, a lot of us, you're exposed to Joseph Campbell through The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and then through the PBS series where he's interviewed by Bill Moyer. Just an incredible sort of conversation.
Brilliant, yeah.
Yeah. Have you thought about having a similar kind of conversation with somebody from PBS?
Well, yes, actually. And I was in a conversation or discussion with Bill Moyer when he had given a presentation at the Seattle Art Museum, and someone wanted to introduce me to him. It was great. We went out afterwards and had a long talk. And he said, "We're going to do a thing with you about this, you know, world mythology and so on." But it never came about. And I don't think now it would have the same effect or the same valence. That was a big thing at that time to have something on that kind of show. Now I think it's way more diversified, but yeah, I did think about that and actually discuss it with him. And at one time, it was in the planning.
Well, if he doesn't pick it up, there is the Voice of Vashon and the Brown Briefly show, which is broadcast online live everywhere in the known universe.
Oh, yeah, there's a thought.
So to follow up, you kind of, I think, began to speak about this when you talked about sort of the inner genius, right, that we can find within ourselves and what that means. And, you know, you talk about authentic self, right? And I think those kind of things kind of interplay with would be my guess, right? And you know, the concept of self, of course, is as old as philosophy, right? That's kind of one of our major preoccupations. And but you know, kind of curiously, this concept of authenticity is pretty modern, postmodern, right? Like that something is authentic. So can you talk a little bit more about, you know, what authentic self means to you, how you talk about it, and why is it important?
Great question, thank you. So authentic comes from the Greek authentikos, and the beginning of it is ortho, from which we get author. And so you get the idea of making something of oneself out of what is essential to oneself. Not just like, I was raised with that bumper sticker, you know, you can be anything you want to be. Well, that's not the point. This point is to become who you were intended to be from the beginning. That's a really old idea, that authenticity comes from like a root in a person's soul, something that was there all along, like a story trying to unfold from within, which makes a person genuine, or is a genuine expression of human life uniquely through that person. The second part of authentic is entikos, which means from the ground of being. So we came here, each of us, each person born is unique. That's the first step of the authentic. And we're here to grow our soul and unfold the inner story, because the uniqueness of the human soul gives something unique to the world that is at some level needed socially, in community, or whatever it might be. And so the aim, in a sense, is to become an authentic person. And there's lots of ways to look at that, but one way that I find important is young people in modern culture are overexposed to inauthenticity, and they develop a heightened sense of the inauthentic. And what they need is an engagement with the authentic. And so if we go from youth to elders, elders would be people who had become themselves and who had risen and fallen in the world and learned something about their own life and their own soul, going through difficulty or even through success. And then they become the depository of authentic wisdom for their community. And there's a secret connection between youth and elders, so that the youth are looking for that thing in someone else that is unique, that is meaningful, that's usually weird, by the way, and that gives them a kind of an imagination of who or what they might become. So that original sense of the authentic becomes the defining aspect of a community or human culture, mm-hmm. in my sense.
Mm-hmm. How do you... let me put it this way. There are certain individuals in the MAGA crowd who, when asked why they voted for our current president, they say because of his authenticity. Is that the kind of authenticity you're talking about?
No, but sometimes you learn the truth from its opposite. And so what's going on there is a misunderstanding. Kind of illogical speech connected to eruptive emotions and incoherent ideas can appear to some people as authentic. To others, it's seen as psychopathology.
I mean, we could explore, sort of chew on whether Trump is his authentic self. And, you know, he's certainly a villain archetype, and that could be, I mean, whether it's corrupted, you know, but it does feel authentic. It does feel like he's genuinely being himself.
He's genuinely being a distortion of who he would be if he was himself. So here's how I look at it. People who don't know who they are will elevate people who will never know who they are. And what I mean by that psychologically is Trump, you know, is diagnosed as an arch narcissist. The narcissist is out of touch with their deeper self. And secondarily, they have a hole in their psyche. So they're constantly trying to fill the hole in their psyche with adoration from other people. And you know how much he loves that. The problem with the narcissist, whatever comes in goes out that hole. So he needs it again 30 seconds later. That's why he has to be surrounded by yes people and so on. But in the meantime, I think he's a blown-up living symbol of what's wrong in the culture. America claiming to be the best ever in the history of the world, and we're the greatest. He's the symptom of that. And that's narcissism on a collective level. And it has a hole, too, because things keep slipping out, including young people getting lost and things like that. And so it's the reverse of being authentic that appears as being authentic. Big problem throughout the world. People who are maybe have a little genius for leadership, but they do not have an awareness of human needs and things like empathy and things like community, and they're being elevated all around the world. It's not just Trump. And then you have Elon Musk joining the band, and as if to say, keep watching. You can see all the symptoms on display. This is what it's like when you give power to people who are not authentic or not genuine. That's my sense of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kevin.
So there is a question here, but I'll take us on a little bit of a journey before we get to that question. Given the discussion of authenticity, probably most of us have heard this guidance. Be the best version of yourself. How do you place that type of guidance into your comments, thoughts about authenticity?
Well, good question.
Is it
again
relevant, or is it?
No, totally relevant. We'll go back to Trump, since he's a dominant theme in the culture. He's the worst version of himself. So imagine, get back to the authentic self. When someone is not embraced and loved by mothering energy from some parental figure, they have a deep, deep lack and loneliness and emptiness that needs to somehow be filled. When you have that kind of early life damage, it's going to be filled inauthentically. Again, back to Trump. He's like a trophy man that needs a trophy woman, that needs a fake trophy from his own golf course, that needs to put tariffs on all other people to keep reminding himself that he's better than everyone, when secretly inside he's empty and less than everyone. That's, to me, what he is as symbol. But I could also imagine, you know, he grew up in New York City, not far from me, and almost at the same time. So I could imagine him going another way. His genius is kind of a interesting wit and a kind of strange insight into the moment. And he probably, you know, like a lot of real estate people and all has some interest in growing things and building things. He could be a very different person. He could be Warren Buffett. He could be all kinds, you know. So I think that's the worst version there, to the detriment of the world now. One psyche in its own distortion and pathology now can affect the entire world. That's another thing about the authenticity of the human soul. The authentic human soul can change the world. And I'll go back to the genius for a minute. My fantasy is that a whole lot of people waking up to their own genius and also waking up to the idea that we're each here to contribute something is the only way to solve the multiple problems we have in nature and in culture, because we're in a very, very strange moment in which nature is rattling while culture is unraveling. And it's just super important time to be alive.
So what are the mythic stories that capture this moment?
I go back to creation myths, which are not hero's journeys, because they're creating the world. And in creation, in my study of creation myths, they're actually recreation myths. So just to take one that everybody knows, but not in its authenticity, apocalypse comes from the Greek word apocalypsis, and we think it means, you know, the, what do they call that, the end of the world, the fiery end of the world, right. or what is it they keep doing with the movies, the zombie apocalypse.
The post-apocalyptic story, what?
Post-apocalyptic, yeah. Well, the post-apocalyptic story in Greek myth is apokastasis, which means the renewal of all the forms of life. But the real meaning of apocalypse is collapse, renewal. Collapse, renewal. And they happen at the same time. We're seeing the collapse. We literally are seeing the collapse, potentially, of the world economy right now, coming out of this one person's psyche and the distortion of that psyche. And so then, but if we understand it as collapse, renewal, the way a forest collapses, and from the falling down trees, the next forest comes up. So there's a natural renewal. That's the kind of story we're in. Mm-hmm.
So if I could check in, you know, a lot of, we hear mythology, anthropology, and I think maybe a lot of our listeners think of back then, right, in history, behind us. But what's your view about your stories and their particular relevance right now in the political climate, and why are they relevant in the political climate?
We're in mythic times again because of collapse and renewal. The people taking apart this radical democracy in which we all grew up in couldn't do it except that the institutions have already become hollow. And so just as climate crisis is changing the entire atmosphere of the world and every place, including Vashon, the parallel to that is the social climate of the world, the economic climate of the world, the political climate of the world is changing just as radically. Mm-hmm. And so so then I go back to creation myths. We are in recreation times. I mean, this is the hopeful way to look at it, that people think the end of the world is coming, but the end of the world as we knew it has already come. The world that people, certain people talk about going back to is gone, it's never coming back again, and it wasn't as good as they thought it was, not for most people. Right. And we're on our way to another worldview that hasn't fully appeared yet, and those worldviews don't appear collectively in the sense that everybody votes for it. It arises in the dreams of the human soul. And so changing the culture, which turns out to engage the energies of renewal in nature as well, requires the awakening of individual souls to their own genius. There are people on Vashon and other places that have as their natural connection to the world an understanding of how to get heavy metals out of a river. There's other people that know how to reinvent funerals and the whole process of dying in a meaningful way, which is helpful to people. And there's all these geniuses that can recreate a complex, interconnected culture connected to nature, nature connected to the cosmos. That's what's trying to happen, I think, mythologically in the current moment.
Wow. We're just really getting into the juicy stuff, you know, and we've got to call it a day. If somebody wants to find out more about you and your podcasts and your books and whatnot, how do they do that, Michael?
Podcast is a weekly free podcast, goes all over the world, called Living Myth. You can find that, Google it. And if you Google my name, you can get connected to Mosaic Multicultural Foundation, which is our organization, and there you can find essays and free videos and all kinds of things, but you can also buy books, and now you can take courses. We have a course on genius, we have a course on finding your own myth, all kinds of stuff like that, and so just track either Living Myth or Michael Mead, and you'll find yourself in this kind of mythic beauty and confusion.
Well, we have lots more that we can talk about. Hopefully we can have you back sometime. We thank you very, very much. It's Michael Mead, M-E-A-D-E, for those of you who don't know, and you want to Google that. All right. Next week, next week's a little up in the air. Kind of depends on our fellow Briefly's health. So we will see how that works out. But join us again, please, for Kevin, Bruce, Amy, Michael Mead, our sickly Truman. I'm Craig, and we thank you for listening. Please tune in next Tuesday for the Brown Briefly Show.